I think they get bored, Chris. I think they just, you know, they release their cameras and then they just sit around and go, what the hell can we do next? And then they come up with some crazy ideas and they put them all in a hat and they draw them out and then they do some product development. I'm pretty sure that's how it works at Blackmagic. So welcome to part two, guys. This is a continuation of the NAB post-show wrap.
So NAB being the National Association of Broadcasters, we've talked about a whole load of products that came out of this this big show where it's like Christmas for us. And if there's a Santa Claus of NAB, it's got to be Blackmagic Design. They deliver every time.
I don't know how they fit down the chimney, Chris.
They are certainly huge. Of course, a Melbourne company up the road in Port Melbourne. These guys just crank out products at a rate which is unbelievable.
But no new cameras this year, interestingly.
No, and put some great upgrades to cameras, some great new innovative products, and
some crazy crap thrown in for good measure.
But it's not crap. It's the best stuff ever. Like, I think
it's that weird looking present under the tree. You're really not sure what it is.
And look, Blackmagic are excelling at this at the moment.
Yeah. I should say Blackmagic is pretty much the poster child for what we on this show stand for, and that is the high end of low end digital media production. I'm pretty sure they're the perfect poster child. So we give them crap, but we love them.
Oh, Blackmagic are amazing. This company, to develop what they are developing in the cycle,
the time that they've done,
time they develop it, they have some of the best engineers with just the know-how of how to make things work. And then they got some amazing UI people who just, I mean, their products are beautiful. They really are beautiful.
And well, they won the Red Dot Award a week and a half ago, yeah, which is an award that's been won by the likes of Apple and Porsche and these sorts of big names. So that's an amazing thing for a little, well, it was a little Aussie company. It's now a big multinational, I would suppose. But
yeah, but they're just on top of everything on as far as the design flow. But they have released some cracker products this NAB.
Weird and wonderful things that you did not know you needed until
Let's
you saw them.
Let's snap through them because I know our listeners have been listening for half an hour already.
Look, I think, Chris, we'll probably end up putting this in two shows so we can spend a little bit of time on some of these because I think there's some interesting stuff in here.
Okay, well, let's go through this. So right. What have we got? We've got the
Duplicator 4K.
The Duplicator.
Yes.
I love the Duplicator. It is 25 SD card reader writer. So just imagine 25.
Imagine a rack unit, one RU, with 25 SD card slots in it.
Vertically. It looks like an equalizer.
It does. From a distance, it very much looks like an equalizer.
Graphic EQ. And then a buttons on the side for record, stop, play, and a little monitor on it, mm-hmm, and a whole series of interfaces. John, tell me this. Well, what is this unit?
Before we even get into that, I want to sort of take a little bit of a step back and talk about what the Blackmagic guys sort of had as a vision for this product, because I think this actually raises a really big question. Before we get into the technical detail, the idea behind this product is that you can record a multicam, predominantly a multicam event, and you can record it to these cards, which is basically the functionality of this particular product. But at the end of the event, whether it's your daughter's ballet or whether it's a local baseball match or whatever it is, you can actually sell something to the people who attended generally and make a bit of extra money as a producer off that. So, again, going back to the ballet example, we've got this one-hour ballet show. You've got three cameras in there, let's say. You've got some dude doing the switching. It all records onto these cards, and then you've got this physical piece of media that you can then go, okay, parents, you want the video of your daughter's ballet? $50. Here you go. And you can take that home, and you can plug that into your new ultra-high-definition TV, and you can see it in ultra-high-definition. So it's Blackmagic's answer, I suppose, to that problem of how do you actually sell this work?
And when you don't have VHS tapes.
Yeah, and the answer up until this point has often been DVD, which comes out several weeks or months later. This is real-time switched at the end of the event. Here it is. You can take it home with you now, and that's when people are most emotionally likely to actually spend the money. So,
well, places were doing DVDs live. Certainly, mm-hmm, I've done a few gigs playing music myself where I've been handed a DVD at the end of the show or had the option to get a DVD. So that was happening. But it takes up, when you've got a rack of, you know, 20 DVD players and DVDs are DVD recorders.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm talking just like DVD recorders, like the consumer recorders. Yep. That's what they would do.
Right.
And then you would take the disc home. But if obviously you've already recorded the media, so you have to kind of say, well, you know, before the gig, I want a DVD.
Yeah, they weren't rewritables.
No, they're not rewritable because rewritable is more expensive. But with the SD card, if people don't buy them all, you just leave the ones in that, you know, you just, at the end of the show, you just
erase it and start again.
You just leave them all in and you just pull them out of the machine as you're selling them, you know.
Yeah.
And then if you, you know, do a mass reformat before the next show.
Yeah.
So, look, great idea. And look, to be honest, in Australia, we need it because we can't, if it's a 16 gig show or if it's 2 hours and it's, you know, 14 gig, 13 gig, this, before you start, you can punch in how much you think is going to take and it will actually, you know, encode to that.
The first question I have about this, and I know you've got your own thoughts, Chris, is SD the right choice?
Are SD cards the right choice?
Yeah.
We're not talking standard definition television, mate.
Sorry. I did get confused when I was watching that, so I should be more articulate. Yes, SD cards, are they the right choice? Because, of course, the other alternative would be USB sticks, and I would argue that that was potentially a better choice in many respects, but I can also see why SD might be the one you want to go with. USB sticks are notoriously crap in terms of read and write.
And you don't have a specification because with SD cards, you've got class 10, class 7, class 5.
And then normally when a reputable company like SanDisk write on the front of the card 90 megabits or megabytes per second write, you can generally trust that, whereas USB sticks generally are a bit all over the place, and especially custom branded ones.
And I do a lot of them.
They're awful generally in terms of read and write.
I've done a lot of custom USB sticks, and I got a slow batch once where for me to write them. I mean, I have two banks of 20 USB stick of 10 USB stick hubs so you can put them on. But the problem is that every USB stick also hogs the bus. Yeah. So really, I had this great idea is you know you just shove them on the 10 multi-way and it would divide all the speed up before I sat and just went, oh, hang on a sec.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't work like that. So I think with the SD, especially with the SD read-writing technology, the actual electronics and the bus to do that is a lot cheaper than a USB bus as well.
Yeah.
So it was just, it made sense because all this stuff was off the shelf. I mean, when you think about it, if you look at this unit and you divide the price of the unit, which is $2,000 US, which is quite expensive, but you think about it, it breaks into $80 per card. So it's effectively for each, you know, slot, you're paying $80.
Yeah.
And on top of that, you've got an encoder and you've got a mini screen on it and you've got the ability.
And it's an H.265 encoder.
Yeah. So that's not a bad deal when you stop and look at it that way.
Yeah, look, a few gigs and you could make your money back. I'm just not totally convinced SD is the right way to go, but I do understand why they made that
decision.
Well,
because most laptops have an SD slot in them.
Yeah, but USB sticks themselves, I think, would be, if you had the choice.
We're looking at the future.
All things were equal.
Yeah, but USB is going towards USB 3 and Type-C.
Yeah, true. Well, look, I guess the other thing is that you're going to record onto an SD card, possibly an H.265. Now, a couple of things with that. Firstly, your TV won't play it unless you have a new TV that can actually do that. So we're talking ultra-high definition TVs, and they're in the minority, obviously, now. The other thing is if you do put it into your computer, unless you're running Windows 10, you can't play it unless you're a bit of a nerd like us. So there's potentially an issue there as well, especially just from a customer satisfaction point in that if you are selling to normal people who don't have the latest tech, they running Windows 7 and thinking that's pretty good, they take this card home, they plug it into their computer and go, this doesn't work, I'm angry. Can see some issues there.
Well, I think this is a product for the future, to be honest. I don't think Blackmagic have made this expecting to people to enable 265 mode straight away. Yeah. Now, my only issue with this unit as well is that they showed they showed an image of this recording unit in a rack unit with four other units sitting in there.
Yeah, so it's got a loop through.
So it's got a loop through to be able to daisy chain the recorders.
Yep.
Now, each of these recorders also had a little screen and record and stop and rewind and the HDMI, they had all the same electronics. Why wouldn't you have a slave unit that's just the SD card read-writer element of it? Like, I don't see why you know, it's a bit waste of money, like buying the same thing three times with the same I would have thought they would have built a slave unit as well. You know what I mean? Look, yeah. It's a great piece of technology. I love it. Look, just to see the image of this, I go to Google, type in Blackmagic Duplicator 4K and just laugh because it's so awesome. You just look at it and go, wow, that's a lot of SD cards.
It is indeed. Like, I will just come back to that briefly, Chris, the append recording feature, which I think is a nice little feature. It's basically that you can add something later on. So you've done your multicam switch, and then you go, oh, crap, we need to put a bumper on the end of that. That's going to add a second file, then it's not going to match up. This actually just integrates that file or that additional recording into the main file. So, again, for normal people, it's just one file. You're not getting an SD card with 26 different videos on it. It will actually integrate all the files into one neatly, which I think is a nice little addition there.
So add on to the end of the MPEG-4 or the H.265 stream.
Yep.
And then change the header at the start. Again, this is an absolute credit to the engineers at Blackmagic. Mm. This stuff is not easy to do. It's very risky to start undoing, you know, protocols and streams and adding, you know, elements on top and without remultiplexing and things like that. So they've obviously put a lot of effort into making sure their coding is very solid.
Yeah. Moving on to another Blackmagic, and there's going to be a few Blackmagic announcements here because they did release a bit of stuff. This one I think's an interesting one. It's something that's quite popular these days, and that is the external monitor. There are two ways you can go about external monitors. One is just as a monitor, just to check things out and maybe add some false color and peaking and what have you. The other way, of course, is to do it like companies like Atomos have done, and that is to actually record as well. And this is in that vein. It's a 7-inch monitor. It's similar to their existing 5-inch monitor. It's the Video Assist 4K.
It is. Little 7-inch monitor with a SD card recorder built into it.
Yeah, as well. Which I like because many of the original recorders from Atomos and the likes used hard drives or SSDs. This just goes to cheap and cheerful SD cards, which is great. It does ProRes in 10-bit and also does DNX HD. It's got HDMI, full-size HDMI, and full-size SDI as well, which is nice, so you don't have those little SDI, mini SDI adapters, which are a bit fiddly to work with. You've got focus peaking and histograms, so great if you're shooting on an SLR and need a little bit more information
about
the video.
Well, these days, a lot of the SLRs are starting to include peaking and things like
that. Yeah, they are.
The only problem is that the screens are really small and you can't see if you're in focus because it's...
Canon isn't, but yeah.
Isn't it?
No.
Well, what resolution
peaking.
Is...
No peaking.
Oh, you're saying they don't keep peaking. Sorry.
No peaking. No peaking.
I haven't used Canon camera for a long time.
Yeah, no peaking, unfortunately, for us. Yeah.
I'm all Sony.
HDMI SDI triggering, handy. So you push the button once and it goes out to the screen and starts recording on the SD cards themselves. Yeah. One of the interesting things that Blackmagic pushed quite a bit was the fact that it had analog in terms of audio.
Audio, yeah.
Yeah, not video. That would be weird. Kind of awesome, but weird. So they have two mini XLR inputs and they advertise them as being quite low in terms of noise floor. And look, that's pretty interesting because it basically means that one of the Achilles heels of SLR shooting has always been audio. So this is basically, don't worry so much about your secondary audio in terms of a field recorder, just bypass it and go straight into this monitor, which I thought was an interesting addition.
Mm. And that does, of course, address quite a few issues as well as far as having to re-multiplex if you're using a field recorder and a any kind of recorder. You know, you end up with three lots of rushes if you're recording internally on
and
the camera.
You can
well.
Also go back out. So you can go from the monitor back out to your SLR. So you get the good audio, the XLR audio going into the monitor, and then you feed that back out to your SLR.
You take a 3.5 mil jack effectively back into your SLR's input and you can put your preamps right down on your SLR and get a low hiss, high quality.
And you pretty much guarantee it's going to sync properly as well in post if you need to do that.
Yeah, okay. So it's a multi-use. You could use it just as a monitor and for its preamp if you wanted to and not even record on it as well. But at that point,
you might as well record the ProRes or DNX HD. And go from there. It's got a kickstand, Chris. That's pretty impressive. So it's not going to fall over. I think that's a nice feature. Dual batteries. So using, again, I think this is somewhat pointed at the SLR shooter. It uses
at the Canon users because it's Canon batteries.
LPE6, which they're a good battery, and they use a lot of Canon models, so I can see why they use that. It's generally, it doesn't matter what product it is, if you're using those little batteries, it's the Sony NP series batteries, mm-hmm. or it's the Canon LP-E6. So they're generally the batteries you're going to with pretty much any product like this. So look, it's got support for the new UHS 2 SD cards, so you can get the nice high-speed, high-capacity cards, which will also work in terms of readers with the older readers as well. They're pin compatible, which is kind of cool. And for $900 US.
That's really cheap.
$13 something Australian recommended retail.
So for that you get a 7-inch. I feel like I'm selling it here, but I mean, I'm just trying to comprehend between what you're getting for $900 US. Yep. Getting a 7-inch like bright monitor with a really good set of mic preamps with proper phantom power on it. So for powering proper shotgun mics and maybe taking a desk from a feed from a desk or something, the ability to pipe that back into your camera or use it as a recorder at 4K to any number of codecs that are built into it. And it's all battery powered and future proofed. It's kind of,
it's pretty cool monitor.
Pretty scary for the price. It does a lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it a monitor though? I mean,
well,
it's a little more than that.
Yeah.
It's kind of a missing bits device.
It's an HD monitor. It does record 4K, but it is only HD in terms of the screen itself. There are better monitors like Atomos released their Inferno, which looks really nice. It's a higher end monitor, more expensive as well. But for the price, I think this is a lot of bang for your buck.
I'm into the video assist 4K. It looks pretty good.
Mm. More Blackmagic news. So the MultiView 4. Chris, tell us about this.
Well, the MultiView 4 is the answer to a very simple question, which I've answered for many years with various solutions. But it's called, the situation is I have up to four inputs, and I only have one screen, and I want to look at all my four inputs on one screen without having four screens in front of me. And if you're doing video switching, you know, you've got a fifth one for your master output and maybe a sixth one for your preview. What are we cutting to next? So all it is a quad split. It's the oldest trick in the book. I mean, the security cameras are the classic. They use them all the time. But it's a quad split on steroids. Like, it runs at 4K, as far as I understand, with its output.
Yeah, so go out to your local retailer and buy an Ultra HD TV and use that as your monitor, which is quite nice. Yeah. You've got audio levels on each of the views, which is good. You've got labeling, so you can actually put in a name for each of the views and tell what the heck they are. You got loop throughs. You can actually run multiple units sort of loop through to do a multi-screen setup. HDMI out or SDI out. So again, the HDMI out's useful if you are using an off-the-shelf TV. Built-in power supply with IEC, and my notes say yay next to that.
So good. It just means you plug in you have a tub of cables and you just plug it in. You don't.
Yeah. And also one of the things I don't like about Blackmagic is they do these really stupid bloody wall warts that go horizontally. They go sideways. So you plug them into a power board and they take up at least two power points. It infuriates me because you need a million power boards to run all Blackmagic gear. So this, I think, is a standard IEC cable, which is fantastic.
And it supports Ultra HD as its input as well, and as it also supports HD as inputs as well.
Yeah, it's $500 US. So there is a bigger brother version, which has been out for a while, and that's the MultiView 16. But if you don't need 16, and not many of us need more than four, this looks like a good product. It's also got, I forget the exact name for it, it's the smart snap-on front panel. Basically, to configure a lot of the stuff, you can either use the built-in dip switches on the front part of the panel, or you can buy, I think it's about $135 Australian, and that gives you some buttons and a screen to actually get a bit of a sense of what's running through the device and give you a much friendlier interface. It's the same size as many of their recent converters. So they've got the smaller converters, which are a bit cheaper, but these higher-end converters that fit in a rack, this is the same size as that. So if you've already bought a few of those and you have the rack, you can mount this 4View in the rack as well, which is kind of nice.
And it's good to have that little screen. I mean, I like the idea that you don't necessarily need to configure this unit, if depending on your use case, if it's a fixed installation thing, or if it's something where you're constantly doing the same thing over and over with it, you would just dip switch it and have it sitting in the back of your case and you never even look at it.
Yeah.
But if you want the ability to change your labels, it's got a knob on the front of this little smart panel as well. You can change your labels, change positioning of stuff, you know, modify it for each event. And look, to be honest, this is a really crazy way, and I know this is a crazy idea, but if you wanted to get four cameras from a shoot and potentially multiplex it into one recording media so that you've got all four of your cameras going to one file, you could potentially do that and have, you know, a multicam that you switch afterwards just by reframing, you know, your shot, if that makes sense.
Hmm. All right. Moving quite along, we've got the micro converter, which Blackmagic have always had these converter boxes. They're quite popular. I think personally Decimator make better ones. But anyway, they make these converters that go, all right, you've got HDMI, you want SDI, you've got SDI, you want fiber, you've got whatever it is, you want some sort of audio out of it. They've released some really teeny tiny ones, Chris.
Yeah, this is simple. 3G SDI to HDMI.
Yep.
Or the other way around.
Fantastic.
$85 US. Bang.
Yep. Look, there's not much to say about these apart from worth having in the toolkit, I think.
Yeah, but just if you're thinking about getting HDMI cameras and just porting it to SDI and that's going to be the same solution as an SDI-based camera, it's not. There are delays that come into play. And
as soon as you use HDMI, there are delays.
And doing this, again, is a delay. The reason you have SDI, I think we've spoken about this previously, the reason you have SDI is because it's an instant down-the-line format. It minimizes latency and lag. And if you've got multiple live cameras with things going on, you want the cameras to generally all be running at the same speed. Maybe if you've got four of them all running together with four cameras or three, it would work. But it is a good way if you want to just get an SDI out of an HDMI or vice versa. Well, but there will be a delay.
Interesting things with this, Chris, and again, this brings me to a larger point perhaps with NAB, is it can run off USB, 5-pin USB. And I've noticed, I don't know if you did, Chris, but a lot of other devices are doing this. And there has been a bit of pushback I've seen in many of the forums around this because it's not a reliable, robust connection. I can see why they did this because basically it means you can put this behind a TV, and many TVs these days have USB ports, and you can run the USB into this thing and power it, and that way it's a nice, elegant solution. It's out of the way. But a lot of these things are starting to use USB power as their main power source. And it is not a robust connection in any way.
Type-C is slightly better, but not that much better.
No. Look, I can see why, because USB is ubiquitous, but it's not a professional connection in any sense of the word. So I'm not sure it's the best road to go down. It seems like a lot of people are going down this road, better or for worse.
I'm just going to bypass that and not say anything. Look, yeah, it's annoying, but I mean, it's cheap, and that's what these products are.
Yep.
Blackmagic Ultra Studio 4K Extreme 3, John.
Ultra Studio 4K Extreme.
You've got the old version, don't you?
Not so much the old version. We use the 4K, the Ultra Studio 4K, not the Extreme. There is no Extreme in our studios. just the 4K. We have a couple of them. First one was dead on arrival, but we won't talk too much about that. This is a box that captures stuff. Actually, no, it's not. It's an interface which enables your computer to capture stuff or play stuff back. Now, there was the older version, which could utilize Thunderbolt 2 for some things, but if you wanted to go above that for stereo vision perhaps or some stuff with RGB vision, you needed to install a PCI card to go with that. And that had a proprietary cable. I think it was proprietary at least. And it was also a very short run in terms of the cable. And with a lot of things going towards laptops and the new Mac Pro doesn't have PCI anymore, that was potentially a bit of a problem. So this is essentially the same thing, but utilizing Thunderbolt 3. And for those unfamiliar with Thunderbolt 3, we're now up to 40 gigabits per second, and that's enough to actually push all the data through for this particular device.
I don't understand why it needs to be so chunky. I mean, why do you need a box with a full LCD screen on it, and a full set of buttons as a capture device. Like, I've been using capture devices for a long time now, and none of them have ever looked like this.
I can actually answer that, Chris. There's a lot of inputs and outputs on the back of it. So, the standard 4K does also have a screen and a lot of buttons on the front of it. This one has quite a few SDI ins and outs on the back, and that's why it's physically a little bit larger.
And so, they just give you an interface to do it so you don't have to deal with software.
Well, yeah, basically.
Yeah, so, which it does get annoying. I mean, even when there was a few inputs on my old, you know, Pinnacle gear from the late 90s, I remember it's still annoying having to go into software and switch things around. And
Yeah. You can do both. On the one we've got, the six buttons. So it's basically, do you want SDI? Forget the other one. Do you want SDI? Do you want embedded audio? Do you want external audio? Those sorts of things in terms of the six buttons, which you can control in software as well. This one's just physically got more SDI inputs on the back and SDI outputs.
Can it capture from multiple ones at once? Could you do two streams of SDI?
There is the old hack that you run through a router and you could potentially split stuff, but not natively, no.
Okay, I was just curious if that was an option.
Couldn't imagine that the Thunderbolt, even Thunderbolt 3, there wouldn't be enough bandwidth if you were doing multiple, let's say you're doing multiple stereo 4K streams, so you wouldn't be able to do it because it's not the bandwidth.
Oh, interesting. Mm. Interesting looking unit though.
So it's the same price as the older model. It's just whether you want the model with Thunderbolt 3, which is kind of like USB-C. In fact, it's the same actual physical form factor in terms of the pin connections. Or you can spend the same amount of money and get the older one and use the good old PCI because, of course, Thunderbolt 3 is on like one computer at this point. So it's something for the future.
Hmm, interesting looking unit. Again, Blackmagic, I'll bring up the point here. It's quite interesting with their engineering teams how quickly they're on the pulse with new formats and new standards. Like, you know, they've jumped onto USB 3 very quickly. I mean, this is a couple of years ago now, but I noticed their devices were amongst the first USB 3 devices on the market. And they seem to be one of the first Thunderbolts 40 gig, Thunderbolt 3 manufacturers on the market as well. They seem to be really quick at jumping on board. And 12 gig SDI, I mean, they had it before. They didn't invent it, but they almost did, you know. It was their products had it first. Yeah. I find it interesting for the price point. These guys are so quick.
Mm. Yeah, I think, well, they have to be because they're built on software and configurability, so they need to be quick. Otherwise, what have they got to offer? They've got price and they've got basically software-driven interfaces and configurability, which is where many of the older things were built into hardware and never got updated, whereas Blackmagic has the advantages where they can add features. Like the switches these days have macros, and when you bought those switches, they didn't have macros, and the macros unlock a lot of power. So it's nice to have that software upgradability, and they sometimes annoyingly, very often release software updates, so you're updating stuff all the time.
But it depends. You don't have to update it if you have
No, you don't. Only if you update one part of it and then the other bit says, no, it won't work until that updates. Anyway, moving on to the Ursa Studio Viewfinder. So the idea behind this is that it's a viewfinder, much like you'd see on top of most sports cameraman's camera, that basically turns the Ursa Mini into essentially a studio camera, a pretty high-end studio camera, a studio camera with a BR sensor inside of it.
Yeah, but I mean, it depends. What lens are you putting on the front of it? I mean,
You can put your B4 lenses on there. You can put whatever you want, Chris, if you got the right adapters. Yeah,
so what's the problem with the current viewfinder or / screen that's on the Ursa? I mean, you know, it's
got a
nice
little
flip out screen. It's nice and bright. It's supposed to be good.
If you're a cameraman who does a lot of sports, you would have a very sore back. Would be the answer to that, I would say. So with these viewfinders for studio use traditionally, it's in a different position. Basically, you're sort of looking up above the camera, and you've got remote focus and potentially aperture and remote zoom. So you've got two handles that you're dealing with, and you're looking up at your screen and you're controlling everything, as opposed to sort of leaning over the camera and looking at the viewfinder or the screen that's built into the camera.
And you do have options for contrast and brightness as knobs on the camera.
Yeah,
on the
physical knobs, not menu systems.
They've obviously listened to what camera operators have said they really like with an old school screen, and they've put that into a very configurable setup by the looks of it. And you've got all your extended information about it, like you've got histogram options and things. Which is that being driven from the camera, or is that all into the screen as well? I'd assume it's on the screen so you can toggle it on and off.
On the screen, yeah. Nice articulating joints. So they gave a nice demo with someone whacking the camera on a good old Miller tripod and using the pan handle in one hand and grabbing the screen with the other. So you could actually do wild pans. They were talking about golf. Now, I know nothing about filming golf, but doing wild pans while still standing in one place and looking at the screen. So that totally made sense to me because sometimes you do need to move the camera significantly and you don't want to be doing a bit of a dance around the tripod. You want to just sort of stand there and look at the screen, move the camera, and then move it back again. So
that, it does have two big handles on it.
It does. Very nice big handles. Mm. Coming out in Q3, no price that we saw just yet.
Which brings us to the big question, will it be more than the cost of the camera?
Hopefully not. It also had a nice big tally light as well. Yeah. You got to love a big tally light.
I love this product. It's a real answer to a problem. You can tell they've listened to a lot of people on this product because you look at it and go, oh, yeah.
Yeah, and look,
that's straight to the point.
As a user of the actual studio cameras, the 4K studio cameras, one of the downsides is the fact that you've got that very big ass, quite nice screen, but it's locked to the back of the camera. So you can't move the camera and the screen independently from one another, which is something that camera operators, especially for sports, need. And if you need to bring the camera up or down, it's potentially at a weird viewing angle and your neck's going to get pretty sore pretty quickly. So this is a nice addition.
Would you say this is the low end of high end? Given the fact the price point on this is likely to be a lot less. You think about an old school camera, what would that be? Maybe a couple $100,000.
With a box lens? Yeah, the lens itself for an SD lens, I think it's about $90,000 back in the day.
Mm.
So yes, it's definitely the low end of high end.
So this is pulling something down which used to cost maybe $150,000, $200,000 as a big solid unit. Mm. I don't know with its cushioning and stuff if it's the same. I suppose they needed that cushioning and air systems in the old days because they needed to move around something that was so big. So these days, if you've got a really good fluid head and something that's smaller, maybe it's pulling it down from 200K to under a 10,000.
You'd still want a pet if you're on a super long lens, I'd say. But for a lot of stuff that's not sort of A-League sport, this could be fantastic. You do have the bigger sensor, so focus might potentially be a bit of an issue, but as opposed to the actual studio camera itself where it's got a smaller sensor. But, you know, it works the other way as well. You might go, oh, well, we can get some really nice images out of this.
So this place in the market for this camera is really for the studios who are covering, or the TV stations or whoever they are these days, are online coverage, covering smaller events to be able to have the same operators on board who are familiar with the big old chunky stuff. Well, the well-designed cameras from the 70s and 60s and 80s, as well, that were super over-engineered to give them that same kind of level of engineering and ability to move around. Is that kind of the market? Do you reckon? I mean, yeah. It's hard to see or is it for a new breed of sports camera operators?
Maybe it is a new breed because I can't imagine there are many people out there that go, okay, we own three Ursa Minis and suddenly we want to go and do sports with them. I don't think that's really the market. I think maybe it is people that go, okay, we want a half-decent camera. We don't want to spend a fortune on it. What can we get? We don't like particular aspects of the 4K studio camera. We want something maybe it's a bit different. Or maybe we want to go for something that's a bit sexier in terms of a look. This might be another option. As with many Blackmagic things, I'm not certain that they've always got the target market completely worked out. I think the engineers sometimes maybe run away with things. But look, there's definitely use cases for it. It's just whether the market will respond to it, I suppose.
The use case for the screen, I have no qualms about it. I can instantly see what that's for. It's what do you attach it to make it, you know, to feature. But yeah, look, I mean, let's move on, but that's a really interesting unit.
Yeah.
As a monitor, full stop.
Yeah. Definitely.
I'd love to just have
a nice monitor with handles on it.
God damn, yeah.
The other thing is related to that, and that is updates software-wise to the Ursa camera itself to enable all of this functionality. So it's all well and good to whack a new monitor on to a camera, but if the camera doesn't have studio functionality, and initially the Ursa Mini never was designed to have studio functionality, it was more as a cinema camera, what's the point? So they've released this update to the camera itself, which adds the studio cameras to the Ursa Mini. It's the 3.2 update. One of the things they do add is the color corrector. So you've got the color wheels there out of DaVinci that you can use to do real-time color corrections, which I find quite useful because sometimes one camera might be a little bit out from the others, so you just want to push and pull the blues or the reds one way or another. Mm. Very important, it's got talkback now. So I've implemented talkback in our studio through the use of aviation headsets and so on. This uses the 3.5mm plug, which, to be honest, would have been a heck of a lot easier. Perhaps not as robust, but would have been a lot easier to get up and running. This camera doesn't have the functionality for the aviation headset, so they're just using what's available on board. So as Chris says, you can plug in your iPhone earbuds with the inline microphone and you can use that for talkback, which wouldn't be too good in a loud environment. But
this is a bit of a secret feature that they had in the cameras, because that is actually a 4-pin connector.
TRRS.
Exactly. So it was always touted as just a headphone output. So we never knew that that had the ability to plug a mic into it as well. Whether now it's suddenly come out, oh, there's actually the option.
By the way,
for talkback on this, that would have changed some people's decisions. They'd have known about that.
You got the camera ID stuff, which is required for the tally and the talkback. You've got camera control via SDI. So with the studio cameras and now with this, you can do things like remote focus and remote zooms if you've got a servo lens that supports it. And also 1080 interlaced video, which makes me shudder a little bit, but it is still very much an important feature, especially for live multicam events.
And I guess that was something that the broadcasters have been asking for. You can tell they've had the conversation where people have gone, oh, look, we'd buy it, but it can't do this.
Hmm.
And so they've turned around and gone, well, what can we implement from these bits of feedback?
And the more features, the better. I actually plugged in the 4K production cameras into the old original ATEM television studio and went, why doesn't this work? It didn't support interlaced at 1080, which...
Wow.
I did not realize until I dragged the cameras over and put them all in and then went, oh, wait, yeah, it's missing that feature. So that doesn't work.
Can you set it up to support interlaced?
If you run it through some sort of adapter, which then puts it out to interlaced format, probably, but no, not natively. Or at least I couldn't when I tried it about 5 months ago.
Interesting.
So it's good that they've added that feature to the camera.
Hmm. Okay, so another Blackmagic thing that I'm very excited about is the Arduino 3G SDI Shield.
I'm just reading my notes here. The first point is what?
Well, I've only got a photo of it in front of me at the moment. I mean, I can... Oh, for those of you who aren't into Arduino boards...
For normal people...
Okay, I guess I've got like five of them. So, it's a little board that is a development kit. It was developed really... for people to easily be able to program. It comes with a programming language where you can define things very easily. Like I got mine and the first thing I did was a flashing LED light. And then I did, I think I made a little synthesizer that made some noise out of like the pins that you connect together with some resistors. So it has a whole load of
robotics
what's
called, and stuff.
Yeah, for robotics and controlling things and turning stuff in and out. You could build a sprinkler system. Anything that has on and off saw or moving, you know.
It's like the hardware version of a Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, and it has a whole load of what's called GPIO on it. Now, you may have heard the term GPIO thrown around a little bit. I think Blackmagic have, interestingly, on their last mini camera, they included a GPIO port on that via serial as well. Mm. And GPIO is general purpose in and out. So general purpose in and out is exactly as it says. It's whatever you want to use them for is pretty general, and you can define exactly what comes out of those pins or that socket. So this is a little board which is called a shield. So what it does is it mounts on top of a little Arduino development board, which allows you to then go in and program and say things like, if I get this signal through the SDI, then do this. So we could make a camera that's, for instance, linked to a sprinkler system just for lulz, so that when you hit record and you zoom past a certain point on your camera, it suddenly fires up a water fountain or something like that. That's the kind of far out stuff you could do.
You could make a clapper, record. Stop recording.
You could. You could make an auto clapper. You could make one of those old school like slate clappers with a blackboard on it with an actuator on it that fires the actuator and actually slams it shut 5 seconds after you press record, and it's 5 seconds after every time. And
purpose whatsoever, you could make a thing slam and then the sound would set off a threshold for a certain sound pressure level and then fire the record based on that.
You could be shooting a music clip whereby it automatically triggers your playback, sets up your lighting patch to run in time and runs everything based on just pressing record and 5 seconds later or however many seconds later on the camera.
Well, you could do it based on frequency. When someone drops the bass...
When someone drops the bass, the camera automatically starts recording.
Yes.
The lights go nuts.
We need, Chris. I think we should patent that.
And you can make it so you could even do a range detection. So if you crash zoom in and out enough times, the bass actually drops.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but you could do all of this just through logic programming. It's actually quite easy to program. And the good thing is this allows you to have that kind of approach as a programmer to, and you don't even really have to be much of a programmer, to say, if this happens from the camera going down the line, if I've seen these things and detected these cases, then do this. So it's pretty cool, but it has to be able to go down a 3G SDI cable. So it's anything within the protocol of SDI. I don't have that protocol in front of me. I don't exactly know everything that you're able to capture, but that's pretty exciting to me.
Yeah, look, the example they gave, we're giving some pretty silly examples here. The example they gave is pretty much the same sort of thing as you can do with the software, and that's playing with the black levels and the iris and stuff, but actually creating a physical joystick rather than a mouse and some software to do the same sort of thing. And they also talked about just getting old school controllers from the, you know, the 90s and pulling out the electronics and using the physical hardware and buttons to reprogram them to act as interface controllers for cameras.
So we've got an old CCU out in the back, which is from
exactly what they were doing.
From the 80s that, you know, in its day was 10 grand. It has a nice big knob for the iris and it has switches for your gain. And so you could actually, for $100 or whatever they're charging for this thing, add that to an Arduino, which is, what, $50, and make a new circuitry, rip all the old circuitry out and make a new circuitry that takes all those encoders and switches and allows you to control Blackmagic cameras. Wow. So if you've got someone who's a super tech savvy person in your station and you're getting rid of all this gear and you're questioning whether you're going to try to sell or throw out all this equipment, you could give it a new life.
Yeah, definitely. And as you say, it is $100 or $95 US, shipping in a few months. It was interesting when I looked at the interview or the presentation from the CEO of Blackmagic. He basically said, yeah, we're not quite sure if we did this for an actual end user product or the engineers just got carried away. I think the engineers just got carried away and they thought, oh, let's just sell it anyway.
No, that's a beautiful thing because I know quite a lot of people who are into electronics like myself and like maybe four or five of my friends who have camera gear and are into this field of stuff. And a lot of universities and stations and places will have cross, you know, interest people who will be able to take something like this and make something really impressive out of it. So I think as a solutions board, and especially with these companies that are specifying, equipment for people when they go in, you know, you might go and order a camera kit and you might have a request for something to go with it. And they can go, yeah, we can do that. And they'll have someone on board who can develop you up something custom for, you know, an extra few $100 using GPIO. What a great product. I've never, ever in the history of camera gear come across a company who's...
You would not see Sony releasing this.
Who's made a Maker Faire style bolt-on. And as the CEO said, that would have been Grant. It's the engineers came up with it and so we released it.
Yeah, it's cool.
What a cool thing because sometimes the engineers make stuff for other engineers and that stuff never, all of the dev kit and internal development stuff, you never see, you know, as an end user. So it's great to see something at that level come out. I love it. What a cool product.
Indeed. One of the other Ursa things, there's a lot of Ursa news because Ursa Mini only just started shipping in terms of the 4.6K version. They've realized that the interface is probably getting to the end of the line a little bit. They've been using the same sort of interface on most of their cameras. And one of the major announcements this year was that they're actually developing a new operating system for the Ursa Mini camera.
Thank God.
So,
so it's the reason I don't own the Blackmagic camera. I can't quite get onto the interface. I don't know why.
Yeah, well, you're coming from a Sony interface person. Yeah. That's a big statement. But this looks really cool. They've basically made it a lot more user-friendly. They've made it so... Most of the stuff you want on screen, things like your shutter speed, your white balance, it all used to be hidden away in a menu. So you'd have to go, okay, menu button, go into the settings, go in the screen that's got the white balance,
yep,
set your white balance, go back out,
that's
see
why
if it
I
looks
couldn't handle
all right.
It. Yep.
Now it's all sort of live. So you touch on the white balance button, then you just scroll through on a slider and the screen's still there. So it's a, you know, a button at the top,
yes,
and then you have a little slider at the bottom and you can see the updates in real time on the screen.
That's
it's a lot
we
more
want.
Fluid.
That's yeah. what we want, an overlay interface that's just easy to get to everything. Oh, yes,
so
great.
This looks like a nice update, something that's going to be really useful to people. And it also includes some other niceties like setting your shutter angle based on the country you're in. So why is that important? Well, flicker of lights can be a bit of a problem with different shutter angles.
Yep.
So the idea here is that you go, okay, I'm in a country that has 50 hertz power or 60 hertz. Just show me shutter angles that are going to be useful to me that aren't going to give me flicker. So
show
just sort of smart features.
Yeah.
Also smart keyboards. So when you don't need, much like your smartphone does realistically, when I don't need a full keyboard on this little screen, which is hard to type on, if I'm typing in a number, don't show me A, B, C, D, you know, the full alphabet. Just give me the numbers. So just switching between different keyboard layouts can make all the difference in terms of getting your metadata in if you are, in fact, entering the metadata on set.
Hmm. Yeah, so it's good to see that them actually, they're moving forwards. They've obviously listened to people on the ground level. And, you know, again, this might be a good thing for, we said this year at NAB that it was a year that a lot of stuff wasn't necessarily released in mass, you know, waves. And maybe, especially on the camera front, this has been some time for Blackmagic to actually refine their
yeah.
current product lineup rather than just pump new stuff out before they've even fixed up problems with old cameras, which
yeah.
isn't something that Blackmagic did. It was a problem that Red had, though. I know when they were releasing new cameras before they had addressed problems with the older cameras. So, yeah, this is a great... that interface change is revolutionary.
So, available mid-year. So, a little bit of time to wait, but considering they've only just released the higher-end version of the camera, anyone that's bought that camera, I'm sure, will be quite happy to get that shortly.
It's an OS. You want to get it right. So,
indeed.
Hats off to them.
Indeed. One of the bigger products out of Blackmagic is DaVinci. So, it's a color grading piece of software that they bought a few years ago now. And at the time, it was pretty revolutionary because they released a version for free. And people are still raving about that fact. There are so many people going, well, okay, this does higher-end color correction. It's also an editor now. Do I need to spend money on Premiere or Final Cut or EDS or whatever it may be? Some people are just going, oh, bugger it. We'll just use this because it does so much and it's free. Now, interestingly, they did actually make a bit of a plea to anyone professionally using this product to buy the full version, which is only $1,000. But for most people, especially students learning, this is an excellent tool. And the most recent version, again, what you were talking about, Chris, it's more about refinement than it is about major new features. However, they did squeeze a few major new features into this release. They purposely called it 12.5 because it isn't meant to be a massive new release as it has been the last few years. It's meant to be a refinement. So all the features that are in there that we love so much, all the color correction tools, all the editing tools have been refined to give the users a nicer interaction with the program. And there's been a fair bit of focus on performance as well. It is a program that can guzzle up CPU cycles, RAM, and graphics cards.
Yep.
And one of the nice things is that you can just throw more food at it and it will continue to consume.
We have.
But
love it.
Anything that's going to provide better responsiveness is a good thing.
My experience with DaVinci in the last two full versions has been dramatic. I started using it, well, of course, years ago when it first became the free version, but very soon after I was doing assistant job on a TV commercial where, I mean, you just have assistance machines loaded up with DaVinci these days. I mean, it takes all the RAW formats, so straight from the shoot, the drives get delivered to you. The first thing you do is put it in DaVinci and sort it out. I mean, it's just the program to deal with
Swiss Army knife.
Deal with the daily deliverables and sort everything out and create your offlines if you're doing that kind of workflow and just check all your footage and tech check, and it's got scopes and you've got an output and it's, you know, you're doing it all on a really reasonable budget. So it's revolutionized the edit assist side of things. I think almost every single edit assist is now using DaVinci as their first port of call. Now, interestingly, It's also, it was never really designed for that. It was a color grading package. So it's almost always used exclusively as the end game as well when you're reconforming and you're actually outputting. So what's happening in the middle? And here's the thing, you can often play back those 4K streams and things in DaVinci, yet you can't necessarily always play them back on other machines. So your edit assist machines, these plebs, well, I'll say plebs, we're not plebs, but the first port of call, not even, you know, the people who sit with the directors are sitting watching and playing back stuff and giving an offline version to someone else to use in another program. It's just, it doesn't make sense. The day that we have an all DaVinci setup and we can just pass it around and be Resolve all the way, I mean, that's not far off. I've started doing editing in Resolve, a few of my own smaller projects. I've had a few issues where I've been shooting XAVC-L, Longop, and when I've scrolled along, there's been a little bit of drag behind and it's been a little bit of catch-ups. But in the last version, which isn't even 12.5, they started to address and fix a lot of that up. So this is hitting the point where I'm thinking, well, future of editing, maybe I actually put it on as an editor and start cutting jobs in it, especially stuff like a TV commercial where, you know, I've just got a few cuts and then I've got want to do a grade. If I want to do variations and do a, like, you know, with different, like even with variations, with title changes and things, we did 8 versions of something the other day with a end tag and things changed. We did everything out of DaVinci. I mean, you have no reason to go back to your editing program for a lot of changes. And if you've got small changes in the edit, instantly onto DaVinci. You know, there's very, it's becoming less and less that we're firing up Premiere or EDIUS to actually use. So I think that DaVinci are a dark, dark horse in this industry, and have in a year's time, some shit's going to hit the fan with Adobe and with Final Cut Pro and the best, because there's suddenly a free program on the market for people who are entering the market anyway to you know, start working. And once they go into the professional field, they can buy the professional version, which is $1,000, given that's quite expensive, but that gives you some real high tech features, stabilizations and trackers and things that you just do not traditionally have and that will allow you to do some amazing effects work. You can do things like lock titles to motion and track titles to motion and stuff, which that's reserved for After Effects. And for, and it's built in to, like, it's cool. So some of the dots that are starting to connect are amazing in this program.
So with a couple of things I'll address there, Chris, you have got some tracking functionality in the free version. It's just the stabilization that you don't get until you get to the pro version. And the other thing you...
Take two.
Where were we?
Oh, I don't know.
So, ladies and gentlemen, you might notice an interesting edit there.
Yep.
Because...
we just ran out of memory.
We ran out of memory.
We accidentally had track 3 armed on the old H6.
Yep.
And destroyed all our bandwidth.
So you got Chris, me, and nothing.
Yes.
In terms of our channels.
But that's okay. We were talking, I believe, about
DaVinci.
And I think I was raving on how I thought it was revolutionary. And yes.
I was talking about the noise reduction and some of the problems I'd had with the noise reduction and things resetting, much like the SD card we just put into the Zoom.
We just went through 4 SD cards before the Zoom. It was resetting and powering off. And,
yes. Yeah. Chris had a lovely SD card that he spent many dollars on, and you put it in and the whole system shut down. So did not appreciate the many dollars you spent, Chris.
No.
Speaking of things shutting down, one of the problems I did have with the noise reduction in DaVinci, which I'm hoping they've... addressed, is that it would reset my computer, which is a problem. So
I've got
an old Mac Pro with an upgraded NVIDIA 680 graphics card, which meets all the minimum system requirements. But whenever I'd enable certain settings within the noise reduction, it would reset the computer, like hard reboot it, not even crash the program, just reset. And I thought, okay, that's strange. I also tried it on a reasonably high-end iMac with 32 gig of RAM, high-end graphics card, all that sort of stuff, and it did the same thing. So kind of weird, maybe it's just me, but hopefully some of these updates they've made in version 12.5 have addressed this. The other thing, Chris, you were talking about tracking kind of the domain of After Effects in many respects.
Yeah.
The other thing that Blackmagic have done is bought out an application called Fusion, which is a compositing application.
They bought out Ion, was it? Ion Fusion, I think it was.
Yeah, a compositing application that was used on movies like Transformers, so a reasonably high-end thing, something that costs $30,000. So they've done the DaVinci treatment to it, and released a higher-end version that you pay for and also a free version. Now, this was a Windows-only tool, but there is also a Mac version now as well. And now they've sort of got the full pipeline, and it's kind of like Fusion's a different program to After Effects, definitely, but they've got the same sort of relationship as Premiere and After Effects in terms of you've got the round tripping. So if you want to do something a bit more high-end in terms of compositing, you can take your clip inside DaVinci and do a round trip out to Fusion, do your compositing, bring it back in to DaVinci, and continue on your merry way, which that's one of the new additions in 12.5, which looks kind of nice.
So it's like, this, as you say, this is Blackmagic. You could do almost like an entire production using just microphones and lenses is the only things you'd need that aren't Blackmagic.
So you've got all this high-end stuff, and then you can output it to YouTube. So they've added a bunch of common outputs, which we laugh, but the reality is sometimes you do just want to whack something out for YouTube.
Oh, is there finally a proper YouTube export out of Resolve?
Yeah, there's a bunch of presets.
Oh, thank you.
So yeah, Vimeo, I mean, YouTube, whatever else.
Yeah, I mean, you can make your own presets anyway, but you often need to send something to a client or to get approval on something, and yeah.
You don't want to think. You just want to go, here's the big button, says YouTube. Yep.
Yep, good. Off it goes. Yeah.
So that's built in. Some HDR grading tools as well. So there's still debates about scopes and stuff like that with respect to HDR, but they've implemented their scopes into DaVinci to deal with that sort of material and a bunch of other stuff. The beta's out now, as Blackmagic tends to do. They go, here's all this new cool stuff. Here's a beta, and they'll refine it, and in a few months' time, they'll release the Golden Master, as it used to be called.
Fantastic. Oh, well, good on them. Resolve is getting richer every day as far as its value to the community and the film world. So, yeah, and to have a free version has been revolutionary. Interesting they are making that plea to professionals because there's a lot of people who are just using it, and I think they're starting to take the restrictions off it. Like the other day you could start to export 4K out of the free version and things like that, and I sort of went, wow, this is, you know, hitting the point now where...
Well, they basically said, look, it pays for development, pay for it if you can. If you're using it professionally, you're making a bit of money out of it. If you want to see these improvements continue, you need to throw us a few coin.
Yeah. I'm on the I've got one paid version of it, but for the other machines, I'm kind of on the wall. It's just handy to be able to throw it on four machines and have people sort of do the half prep stuff and in a style where you can't really justify owning it on that machine, but you still have access to it. I think that's their logic as well, though. I mean, especially in the assistant world where, you know, you can throw it on a laptop or different places. It means that people can go home and sleep. I mean, edit like assistant. Sometimes, you know, you have something where it's all got a bit furry and you can have it on a portable drive and sort it out on your lappy and then take it back. And that's pretty cool, like, you know, to just have a license that allows you to do that. So, yeah, I think I like this idea of them asking for people to pay for it now, though, because there's a few instances where I think people should be paying for it.
Yeah.
Certainly in production houses. I've seen some post houses with second and third suites using it and just laughing at how good it is having the free version. Yeah. You know, guys.
Yeah. Look, Crystal, we're up to our last Blackmagic item. There's been a bit. There's still some more news to come. But the last item we've got here is an update to the ATEM switches. So Blackmagic make these things called the ATEM live switches. They've done an update which basically enables their HyperDecks, which are recorders, to be used essentially as media players. So these are generally SSD recorders that you can play stuff back from. And now the software can use the content of the SSDs as part of the media pool for player. Not massive news, but it made me think of, cartridge devices. SSDs, throw in your media and play a sound effect like radio. It's a bit of a weird thing, but...
Well, you could have a whole load of media that's been pre-prepped elsewhere.
You could.
Ready to go. Yeah. And
a bunch of motion graphics or whatever.
And rather than having it on a network drive or something a bit risky, you want it mission critical, you just have it on the cartridge ready to go and have that as your show cartridge.
It makes me think of old school radio. Just whack in a cartridge or an SSD and play it off.
Yeah,
so,
great idea. Well, that's one worth looking at.
Apple is killing QuickTime for Windows, Chris.
This is probably the biggest announcement of this week.
Well, yeah, announcements an interesting word. The way it came out was, I think a security company sort of said, well, there's a few bugs in the QuickTime player. You should probably uninstall it. And that's an issue for Premiere. Because Premiere actually uses QuickTime as the underpinnings for its ProRes and DNX HD stuff. So it's put some Premiere Windows users potentially in a bit of a weird situation where if they're worried about security, maybe they want to get the QuickTime player off their machine, but at the same time, it's going to break a lot of things potentially.
Well, my question is, does Premiere have, like, have they, because they, because your standard QuickTime can't play back ProRes, can it?
I'm on a Mac most of the time. If you install QuickTime, then you can play it back through applications, but I'm not sure if the QuickTime player itself would play back.
Right,
ProRes.
That must be what it is then. Yeah, but because I thought the QuickTime or the ProRes element of the QuickTime codec came with Premiere as it shipped with a ProRes decoder.
Well, apparently it relies on QuickTime to actually work, and Adobe said this, so this could be a bit of a sticky situation. The fact of the matter is that the security vulnerabilities are in the QuickTime player, as far as I understand it. So, again, I think you could delete the QuickTime player, get rid of the security vulnerabilities there, and still keep the codecs. And that, I think, should solve the problem. Now, it doesn't speak to the wider issue of, okay, what do we do next? So Adobe's probably scrambling a little bit to work out what their next step is.
But who uses a QuickTime player? I mean, as long as Mac still produce... They're killing QuickTime for Windows, what, the whole thing or just the player element?
They're killing the whole... They are killing it. They're not going to update the thing anymore, and there are security vulnerabilities discovered in the player at this stage.
Right.
So it's the end of the line as far as we understand it for QuickTime 7 on Windows, and that means that many of the things that tap into that, like Premiere, might suddenly... be at this weird crossroad.
Is it because, to some degree, if they've discontinued it as well, they wouldn't allow Adobe to bundle QuickTime Installer with
perhaps
CS?
Yeah.
That would be a problem. Yeah, and then if you can't download it from anywhere.
And Adobe's always been very proud of the fact that they don't really have a codec of their own. They just are like, oh, bugger it. Just give us whatever you got and we'll try and play it back. But now they might have to start the shift to something else quite rapidly, in fact, because otherwise I'm not sure what they're going to do. So, look, it's still sort of up in the air. No one's really certain on what's going to happen, but it's an interesting development at least.
Mm. Yeah, I would assume they're going to kill the player and then they'll have a special QuickTime codecs kind of offering that they give to Adobe. And
well, there's always been an open source implementation of the QuickTime codecs, and... that may be a solution. I'm not sure how well that works with the ProRes stuff, but maybe they could go down that route.
Mm. It's a matter of, once you're charging for it, whether Apple will play game with that.
Back to Zoom. Now, we just had some fun and games with our Zoom crashing and running out of memory. Zoom
released a couple of things. Not reading any memory cards that we put in it, and then, anyway. It's 3 weeks in a row now we've had problems with our Zoom. What was the one we had with that?
I worked out what the problem was, and it wasn't the Zoom.
Take that back.
It was XLR cables that had degraded.
Oh.
Yes. And I realized this because I had another one do it that wasn't connected up to any kind of Zoom, and it was giving me alien signals as well. So just a tip, handy tip from the Purple Fringe. If you've got really old XLR cables, they eventually decay and start to pick up alien signals.
Wow. Can I grab that cable so I can run an impedance test on it? Have you still got it?
Threw it in the bin, so it depends if the cleaners come tonight or not.
Okay, I wouldn't mind that cable because I would love to actually get that on a bench and impedance test it and see what's actually happened to it.
Mm, okay.
Yeah, anyway,
quite a few of those cables and they're all about the same age, so they'll probably all start to drop out very soon.
Ah, worth testing.
Yes.
Hey, so Zoom have brought out their U44 handy.
And the U24 handy.
And that word handy means you could hold it in your hand, but this is
Why would you, Chris?
Why would you hold this in your hand? This is not an audio recorder. It is an audio interface.
Mm.
So think, your M-Audio or your little Motu box that sits next to your computer, but it's got a grip on it so you could hold it in your hand with the USB port trailing
behind
you.
It is a weird-looking thing. Every box, like the M-Audio you mentioned and Roland's boxes and Cakewalk boxes and all the boxes we've seen, they're a square slab that you put on your desk, and that you've got some knobs on the front and some ports on the front and some ports on the back, and that's how we do it.
And there's some tabletop versions of that as well, and that's cool. There's some chest cams and things, and they're a nice tabletop unit. This one
then
has
you've got this thing.
It has the same adapter with the XY mic option on it. So you could now.
Well, it's the connector. So you could have an connector. XY, or you could have a shotgun. Imagine having a shotgun on it, Chris. Wouldn't that be interesting?
I'm trying to think of a use case really terribly to use this thing. I mean, I'm sure it's a good little sound card, and it does have, you know, the same look as the Zoom. It's kind of like what I've got the H6 in front of me here. I'm just looking at it. It's the same kind of knobs and design, but I'm just struggling to know why you would make it a handheld style unit.
Yeah, it just seems like they couldn't be bothered redesigning it and just sort of whacked it into a sound interface.
And a lot of the things is these, the H6 and the H4 and the rest of them, they do actually work as a sound device. So as a like sound card style device, so you plug them in and they'll pick up as a sound interface, and you can just use them as a recorder straight into your computer, no problem. Mm. So the kind of people who are going to buy these units are the kind of people who are likely going to need a field recorder, and they're trying to kill two birds with one stone. Why do you take out the biggest selling feature of it? I don't understand.
Mm. Look, it's interesting. Connects up to iPads and stuff, so maybe there's something to that, but I would either buy a different brand or I would use the field recorder. I'm not quite sure why.
You mean you wouldn't Velcro it to the back of an iPad?
No idea. No, I wouldn't. There's an idea. I'm not sure it's a good idea.
Yeah, but you could. If you were doing radio cross-twos, you could have a piece of audio software. You could be doing interviews and sessions and uploading stuff straight away afterwards and editing straight away.
There's a scenario. You got me there, Chris.
We'd be good with our hypotheticals tonight. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Our last news item from NAB was going back to Adobe. So they gave a bit of a sneak preview, as they tend to do at this time of year, of their upcoming features, specifically for their video products. So because Premiere and After Effects.
Of course, last year was the revolutionary announcement that they would have Morph Cut. How many times have you used Morph Cut?
I forgot about it until just now.
And I can see you in pain.
Oh, I know why I forgot about it, because I didn't want my students using it to cover up dodgy edits.
So you never showed them?
No, because it just informs poor practice when you're in the production stage.
I actually had a bang on it on a few productions recently, and I thought I'd got away with it. And then the client was watching it. She's like, looks a little bit strange right there. I'm like,
That's just the morphing.
That's just the morph cut. Yeah. I thought I'd actually got away with it.
Don't you remember the Michael Jackson videos? Wasn't it so cool?
Hey, I spent a long time setting up morph points when I was a kid.
Yeah, so did I. Me and my cat, we often morph together.
God, John. That's anyway, terrifying.
It was terrifying. All right. So what the heck did they do? They showed off, I said Premiere, I said After Effects. They also did some audition stuff. But the thing I noticed primarily with their Premiere little demos, I suppose, is proxies, transcoding. All this stuff that has kind of been the opposite ideal of what Adobe's tried to do with Premiere. Like Final Cut's always... Well, Final Cut 10 has been pretty good with proxies. You import them, you can generate them. At the time of import, you can switch between them with one button. That's one of the things I love about Final Cut 10. Premiere's added the same sort of functionality. So on ingest, you can transcode, you can copy, you can generate proxies, and then you can switch between them very easily. Now, their use case scenario is for people who, A, are dealing with these new very high-resolution cameras, so 6K cameras or whatever it may be, and you just want to be able to play that stuff back, but also for the portable editors on laptops or Microsoft Surface or something like that. And of course, they're flogging their Creative Cloud syncing service, blah, blah, blah. It goes up to the cloud. It comes down to your laptop. I'd rather just transfer it on a hard drive or over a local area network. But the idea is the same, that you can go to a lightweight device, do your editing, and then conform back to the high-res stuff at the end of the day. So it's interesting.
It's just an auto-conform, basically.
Yeah.
And that's going to take a lot of a lot of annoyance, a lot of pressure off assistant editors and things.
And it can also do it with the Adobe Media Encoder in the background as well, so you can start cutting right away. Now, many systems have had this for a long time. It's just interesting that Adobe's they must have just realized that, yeah, we're getting to the point where you cannot just throw 6K videos in multiple streams at a computer, even if it's an absolute beast, and expect it to play back. So we need proxies. We need these lower res versions.
It would have been really helpful when I was doing stuff back in 1999 and DV was, it struggled with SD and DV. So you'd do a proxy version, you'd cut off your proxies, and you just have the file names as the same file names.
Mm. And
you
just swap them out.
Rename the folder afterwards. Yeah.
Yep.
And it worked fine.
The
I had a batch
way.
File, an online, offline batch file that would just do one way or the other. You just have to minimize. Oh, no, you had to shut down Premiere and restart it.
Yep.
But, yeah, it's people have been doing that same thing for years, near enough. It's great to actually see them finally 20 years later, you know, almost 20 years later, add that feature. That's all I've got to say.
They've also done some upgrades to their Color Corrector plugin, which I quite like because it's kind of similar to Lightroom and I use Lightroom. So it's less traditional, I would suggest, but for any photographers especially, the controls make a lot more sense, I'd say, with the way it's all laid out and the way you're dealing with color and white balance and so on. From what I've seen, it's more approachable for normal people than the traditional three-way color correctors and RGB curves and those sorts of tools.
Mm, a little bit more push and pull of like EQ style stuff.
You've got built-in immersive video drink.
Are we out of alcohol? We said the immersive video word.
I am out of alcohol, so I can't drink. But anyway,
yeah, so am I.
Built-in immersive video support. Now, as far as I can tell, this basically means that it displays it in a way that's not all distorted and warped, and also that you can actually rotate around the view. What I'm not sure about is whether you can specify a default view on cut, which to me is actually an interesting thing if you can, because one of the big issues, as we've discussed prior with immersive video, is the concept of editing. How do you edit? How do you edit without disorientating your viewer? And if you can reorientate the viewer on the cut purposefully, I think that goes a little bit of the way towards solving that problem. So when you make a cut, suddenly the viewer, no matter what they were looking at, is now looking at a point of interest in the next scene. I think that could be an interesting way to deal with that potential problem. Chris, any words on that?
Oh, yeah, it's an interesting problem cutting from A to B with immersive video.
Hmm.
As you said, I mean, the best thing to do is fade out and then fade back in. Maybe it's a good idea to just have some immersive tools like a preferred maybe it'll do things though like that, you know, like a transition or something that opens up from a certain
a
point
wipe.
And it but it has the ability to maybe put software wipes in, or sorry, encodec wipes, where it will actually know where you're looking at the time and begin the wipe from that position or something like that. So maybe there's some metadata that it can generate for a future format or something like that. I don't think there is really a good enough immersive format yet that actually carries across for editorial content anyway.
Yeah,
I don't know. Personally, I mean, immersive content, I mean, it's not virtual reality. Let's not talk about that again.
All right. Moving on. After Effects, nothing, I may have missed something, but nothing super major that I saw in After Effects that's all that exciting. They have added a lot of GPU-powered filters.
Good.
And my goodness, After Effects needs it. Apple dropped the ball on this. They had this application called Motion, which still exists and is still a great value at $50, and you can still do some fantastic things with Motion. It had GPU powered everything 10 years ago. After Effects is only just now sort of catching up. So
they've always had GPU acceleration, but just not on everything.
And it hasn't worked very well.
And the third party programs that did have 3D acceleration were always a step ahead. So you would use your plugins to do some stuff. But
look, at the end of the day, in my opinion, After Effects is slower than it should be. For the sort of CPU power we have these days, the application just, it has improved a lot in the last couple of versions, but it still feels like it's built on really rigid, rickety code that just needs a good clean out, I think. So filters, I guess, are one step in the right direction. In terms of Audition stuff, as they have tend to have done in the last couple of revisions, they've got some more presets for dealing with common issues, noise and dialogue, all that sort of stuff. They're not actually, many of these are not actually doing anything new. They're just sort of repackaging existing filters as something that's consumer friendly. So the dialogue radio announcer preset, for example, which might work, but all it's doing is adding three different effects, and then the user's sort of left going, okay, what do these effects do and how do I tweak them if it didn't work straight away?
And the problem with that is that every input is different. So you never know what your settings and your thresholds and everything is going to be until you are smart enough to actually use those controls. You know, they're there for a reason, especially these, you know, these bigger plugins. You look at the Isotope plugins and things, they're quite complex, and they're complex for a reason, you know. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm all up for the presets here and there. I mean, it keeps the industry dumb, which means we can make more money. Anyway, that's not entirely true.
That's the end of the news this week, Chris. It's been a big one.
Yeah, God. I think we might have to break this into two shows.
I think we will. So, if you heard any strange edits during the show today, guys, bear with us because we'll probably split this up into two separate shows. But before we finish up, we do have some beers, Chris, as we tend to do.
Do you know the audio recorder's dropped out? No, it hasn't. I'm joking.
Chris is messing with me. It's been a long day. Yeah, we've got some beers. So they're the Two Birds Golden Ale. A couple of Golden Ales in a row now, Chris. Now, Two Birds, I knew about these guys because there was a competition. I forget the exact name of the competition, but these guys won. When I say guys, they're actually gals. So Two Birds, two women, started up a brewery to brew some nice beer. And this one, well, look, it's all gone, Chris. So I think we enjoyed this one.
Yeah, it's a pretty light going beer, 1.1 standard drinks. It's fantastic. Really, really enjoyed drinking this. As it says, light honey malt, stone fruit and spicy hops. And I would say all of that is true in this. It was just really easy to drink. For a lighter beer, and certainly for a golden ale, it certainly wasn't devoid of flavor. It certainly had closer to an IPA than most golden ales would be. Like, it had that hoppy kind of very exploratory flavor to it. Like, there's a lot going on. You could sit and drink it and go, what's going on here?
It had a nice flavor in the sort of mid part of the palate. It's definitely very approachable. It was about $19, I think, for the six pack, so it wasn't too expensive. And overall, yeah, this is definitely one that I'd seek out again.
Fantastic. Two Birds. I'm down with it.
All right, Chris. Thank you very much for joining me. Thank you, listeners, for joining us. And we'll see you next time on the Purple Fringe.
Excellent. Until then, have yourself some good production times. And this is why we're going to have a part two. John, wrap up.
Yes. Join us for part two.
Come on, you can go a bit more than that. Well, how about we talk about a beer that we've got on the show?
Hang on, sorry. I'm lost. Where are we?